Asia. She is a founder of the Social Work Alumni Association in the Cook Republic. She is currently working as a team member of the International Research Project on Community Engagement and Health Governance in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, founded by the Aga Khan Development Network and Washington University in St. Louis. She has coordinated a variety of development programs in Central Asia with organizations including USAID, Asian Development, and the European Union. She's an honorary fellow with the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia here at the UW-Madison. And this year you've completed your PhD, congratulations, from the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And before that, she had completed a master's in social work from Washington University in St. Louis. And the topic of her presentation today is Understanding Women's Experiences of Domestic Violence in Kyrgyzstan, a Grounded Theory Study. So please join me in welcoming Dr.
Thank you, Yulai, for introduction. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you for being here today and thank Krieger for the opportunity to present my research based on the dissertation I conducted in Kyrgyzstan. So the purpose of this presentation is fourfold. It is to build a background and rationale for the study. It is to provide a theoretical framework and research methods that focus the study's research questions. It is to explore the experiences of women, survivors of abuse in Kyrgyzstan, in order to understand their health-seeking and coping mechanisms, and to reflect on the implications and for interventions and preventions that could be made for research policy and practice to address the problem of domestic violence in Kyrgyzstan. So as part of building a rationale for the study, I'd like to start by articulating why we need to study this problem in Kyrgyzstan. Well, as many of you know, Kyrgyzstan is one of the former Soviet Union republics located in the northeastern mountainous region of Central Asia. And there are several unique aspects that make the study timely and relevant. Well, first of all, there are very few studies that have been conducted on this topic in Kyrgyzstan. In fact, none in social work. And I think my work is first in social work to describe the experiences of women and explore common elements to draw implications for social work policy practice and research. Second, in response to the international human rights efforts, the government of Kyrgyzstan has publicly recognized that violence against women is a public policy and not just a family issue, and has recently undertaken both policy and legal initiatives to address the problem. And it ratified the CEDAW Convention in 2002 and adopted a law on social and legal protection from domestic violence. However, although these steps certainly helped to acknowledge the problem and helped women to introduce temporary restraining orders, they also revealed some challenges and inconsistencies in the implementation of the law. Third, since independence in 1991, the government of Kyrgyzstan has actively promoted the development of civil society, which resulted...
Of course, it never did this at 10 this morning when we tested it.
Okay.
Just double check that all of your connections are tight.
Because I'm thinking... Like
that. Yeah, I think
we did a dry run this morning, and of course everything worked perfectly.
I'm willing to bet the dongle is just
okay.
Yeah.
And so this promotion of development of civil society resulted in proliferation of women's organizations to improve conditions of women. However, even though these efforts have been instrumental in drafting and passing the law, these organizations have been unable to address the issue at the societal level. And finally, there's some evidence to suggest that women in Kyrgyzstan are becoming increasingly vulnerable to domestic violence as they bear the brunt of the unprecedented socioeconomic upheaval following the collapse of the former Soviet Union, resulting in negative consequences for women. And this is an illustration of such a gap between sort of the wishful thinking of becoming this free market economy and democratic society and the real situation of women, because the rising level of poverty, a widening urban and rural divide, rising unemployment, and deterioration of women's access to public services, and resurgence of patriarchal values and traditional values have resulted in growing prevalence rates or new manifestation of domestic violence, such as trafficking in persons and bride kidnapping. So together, these circumstances create a compelling rationale for deepening the domestic violence research agenda in Kyrgyzstan. So what we know about the extent of domestic violence in Kyrgyzstan is that 23% of all women ages 15 to 49 have experienced physical violence in at least once since age 15, and 38% have experienced it within the past 12 months. More than half of the women indicated that as a result of domestic violence, they suffered persistent health problems or physical injuries, and only 39% sought help. And I think it's important to point out here that governmental data on violence against women is limited, often referring to registered cases as opposed to estimating broader prevalence. And so evidence from local non-governmental organizations suggests that the figures are much higher and that most abused women prefer to stay silent and not seek help. So despite a seemingly remarkable progress in the advancement of understanding of the scope of domestic violence, little is known about how women in Kyrgyzstan cope with violence and decide to seek help from the women's own perspective. So given this lack of empirical and theoretical foundation of cross-cultural understanding of domestic violence in Kyrgyzstan, the study aims at building a substantive theory of help seeking and coping using grounded theory methods developed by Glaser and Strauss. So my own understanding of domestic violence has been informed by several theories that helped me sensitize to the problem, but I've elected to use symbolic interactionism, feminist, and ecological framework for this dissertation. I'm not going to bore you with the details of each of these theories, but I think it's important to point out that grounded theories rooted in symbolic interactionism, which focuses on how people socially construct meanings and how these meanings then represent the respondents' own versions of reality. And instead of having these preconceived theoretical formulations of what the data is likely to suggest, grounded theory assumes that we can't take any existing theories for granted, and that we have to build up from real people's lived experiences before we can say that we can have some kind of generalized idea about the situation. And so grounded theory assumes that we're not just theorizing or hypothesizing about the patriarchy or other environmental factors that perpetuate violence, but that we demonstrate the creation of that patriarchy by the way we construct this understanding from the women's words. So this research involved a three-year-long study beginning in the fall of 2012. The participants were 16 women, ages of 20 to 49, who were residing at the shelter. Duration of the abuse ranged anywhere from 2 to 17 years, with all of them having children, ranging from 1 month old to 18 years old. And the women's education ranged from primary school to bachelor's degree, and income ranged from approximately $2,000 a month to poverty level. The data collected from the interview was digitally recorded, transcribed, and translated into English. And in this study, I used a collection of analytic techniques to engage with the data. And this demonstrates methodological integrity with respect to Sharma's application of grounded theory, and also speaks to the rigor of this study. I used a multi-stage grounded theory process of constant comparative analysis, theoretical sampling, and situation, where eventually stopped when no new information was emerging around key concepts. Saturation was reached when 16 participants in interviews were completed and analyzed, at which point enormous data was collected, a little over 1,000 pages of transcripts and translation. So based on Lincoln and Guba's trustworthiness framework, I've attended to the rigor of the study in the following ways. I was very purposeful in giving the woman's specific words primacy and maintained what is called an audit trail of the text and analysis based on them. So with the richness of all these data, substantive theory was generated to provide a more comprehensive understanding of health seeking among abused women. The theory suggests that the culture of gender equality and acceptance of domestic violence are primary barriers for help seeking. And a sub-theory suggests that domestic violence victims became involved with the criminal justice system because they viewed the system as a logical external resource for obtaining help. However, there was very little support when they needed it the most, particularly during their initial contact with the police. So there are several unique aspects or themes to that substantive theory on help seeking. First, there are themes related to cultural barriers around social construction of marriage and the shame of divorce, cultural beliefs and social sanctions that play a powerful role in discouraging women from seeking help, and the status of daughter-in-law and role of the mother-in-law in the Kyrgyz society. Second, there are themes related to legal barriers that have to do with lack of institutional support and lack of recourse within the criminal justice system. And third, there are systemic and more universal financial barriers, such as lack of housing, childcare, and employment. So as you can see from this conceptual model of barriers to help seeking, the first theme is surrounded by the cluster of cultural norms and expectations that create important barriers to help seeking. But as we go on to create further barriers, such as legal and systemic barriers, which I'm going to deconstruct later in my presentation, together these barriers keep forcing the woman back and preventing anything from changing. So what one has to understand about the social construction of marriage in Kyrgyzstan is that for many generations in Kyrgyzstan, if the girl was getting married, she was leaving her birth family forever. And the Kyrgyz proverb, like the girl who is married belongs to someone else's family, means culturally in Kyrgyzstan that the girl essentially leaves the family sphere and becomes the property of the other family. And so the girls are not encouraged to seek parental support after marriage because they're socialized to resolve their own problems by themselves and focus on the matrimonial family. And so as a result of this cultural expectation, the women essentially lose the protection and linkage to their birth families in the course of marriage. And at the very beginning, there are these cultural biases that push against help seeking. And the cultural construct that seems to be in force is that the birth family does not want to take them back, even when they're being abused, because that is somehow shame on the birth family. Mm-hmm. These quotes make this point very clearly, that the woman went back to her birth family after these constant episodes of abuse, and that her birth family did not want to give her refuge and literally pushed her back into the house of the abuser. And why? Because they already had the shame of the divorce of the older sister and couldn't tolerate having the repeat of that. And these quotes illustrate how strong this normative about marriage is and how strongly it seemed to cut off a venue for help seeking. Deeply ingrained cultural beliefs and social sanctions played a powerful role in discouraging the women from seeking help. Women provided several explanations as to why they endured the abuse and couldn't seek help. And this was evidenced mostly by the proverbs and sayings that they used in their stories. A typical proverb that was cited by the woman was, good wife, good husband, good deputy, good Han. Well, this proverb reinforces this cultural notion that the husband's behavior is shaped by the wife, and it's the wife's responsibility to smooth out family disagreements. And if the woman is not able to manage and somehow avoid to being heard, it is considered that she's guilty of not fulfilling her duty as a peacemaker and caretaker in the family. Another common Kyrgyz proverb used to explain family conflict was, plates and dishes smash and married couples clash. And the assumption underlying this proverb is that the family conflict is a natural and inevitable feature of every marriage, and therefore, it can't be helped. I mean, if people live in the same house, they're inevitably going to be some collisions, and it's normal. But if today the married woman quarrels and the next day she makes peace, then the problem is not even worth any attention because it's, you know, here one day and gone the next day. Respondents provided other proverbs that explained reasons why women endured the abuse and did not seek help. And these explanations included the belief that perseverance wins, and that the woman is supposed to be strong and able to endure everything. The divorce is shameful, and that the woman has to stay and accept her fate once she's married, and that the family problems are not supposed to be discussed outside of the home to prevent washing dirty linen in public. Finally, the women were told that it was women's responsibility to keep the family intact for the sake of the children, and that the children should not grow up without a father. Another very important theme that runs incredibly strong throughout all of the interviews is the status of daughter-in-law in the Kurdish society. And what emerges from the interview is that domestic violence is connected with family cultural traditions about family structure, power, and status within the Kurdish family. Particularly when the wife moves to the husband's family, it puts her in a very disempowering position because she is subordinate and she has basically no rights. And so it's easy then to justify that she's not doing the housework right, that she's not behaving well enough, and beat her up and do violence on her. And I think this quote demonstrates this. Another thing that was so culturally embedded was the role of mother-in-law in the Kurdish family. And when an important cultural pattern comes out of the interviews is that Kurdish women typically don't just simply marry the guy and go have, you know, their nuclear family. They often live together with the husband's family, and they're a big part of their lives. And this, culturally, the husband's family plays a significant role that frequently seems to be supportive of the abuse. And the following quotes demonstrate this and also show how the mother-in-law actively promoted and took a part in such actions from the abuse. Another cultural construct that prevented women from seeking timely help was the cultural value placed on virginity at the time of marriage. And so on the one hand, this factor seemed to enable bride kidnapping, because once the woman has been deflowered, the man could claim her. But on the other hand, if the woman was not a virgin, she was even more devalued, thereby creating even more rationalization and justification for abuse. And this conditions the way domestic violence is played out, and particularly the way help seeking plays out. And I think the following quote demonstrates this as well. Another cultural theme cited by the respondents is the importance of bearing a son, because a son matters so much for the continuation of the family line. And not only is this factor an indication of devaluation of women in the family, but also a pretext and blaming trope for further violence and abuse. And so as this quote demonstrates, the woman is held responsible and is being shamed for not having produced the son. The final cultural theme reported by the women was the use of religion by the partners to justify violence in the family. And for example, partners believe that a woman is full of Satans, and so therefore she should be beaten from time to time to get rid of those Satans. According to this philosophy, the wife should surrender to her husband, and the husband should surrender to God. And the following quote explains how the husband beat his wife as a result of this religious belief. So next I'm going to talk about legal and systemic barriers that women experience seeking help. And one of them is the ineffectuality of the police response to abuse. And respondents most often indicated that they saw the justice system as the logical external resource for obtaining help, but ironically, the justice system emerged as one of the most significant systemic help-seeking barriers, in which it was at best selective and at worst part of the problem. As this case points out, the system is compared with a soap bubble, a superficial system that existed for appearance sake. And this theme kept coming out in all of the interviews, like one more piece of the puzzle, where I had this difficult case where the abuser was the former law enforcement official, and the other law enforcement officials essentially protected and supported him through a type of camaraderie called esprit de corps, whereby the wolf doesn't betray the wolf. And this quote shows that there was complete impunity for the official, that even in cases when a court protection order was issued, the survivor consistently described it as a meaningless piece of paper that didn't serve even as a minimal deterrent. Many participants described cases when the police ridiculed the victims and told them to reconcile with their husbands because they wouldn't intervene in the family issue. And as you can see from these quotes, the police makes fun of the woman who's practically in homicide and frees the husband up in 2 days after the relative space will pay the bribe. And reporting the abuser to the police becomes even further blaming trope for the abuse and barrier for help seeking for the victim. In general, use of health services such as hospital and outpatient clinics was only mentioned in the context of obtaining medical help. But I think this case is instructive because it illustrates the inherent difficulties that the victims have if they wish to pursue legal action against the perpetrator. And in this case, the woman described that she was referred to the Office of Judicial Medical Expertise and underwent the examination, but because she couldn't afford for the tests, she didn't receive the necessary certification to file charges against her husband. In addition to cultural and legal barriers, such as lack of housing, there were systemic barriers such as lack of housing, childcare, and employment opportunities. The most common reason for not leaving a violent home was that women had no other viable housing options. And one woman expressed that, you know, not wanting to seek help from her family was that she didn't want to be a burden, and she believed that staying with relatives was particularly difficult when the children were involved. Another important concept that emerged from the data is coping and resiliency of the women experiencing the abuse. And as you can see from this model, the strategies that women used for coping were divided into two categories, emotion-based and emotional-focused and problem-focused. But what's important to understand about coping mechanisms of abused women is that even though the strategies are divided into sort of two separate continuums, the boundaries of passive versus active are less clear in the context of cultural constraints in which women coped with abuse. For example, the seemingly passive strategy of, you know, placating the husband or refusing to have communication or sex with him could be regarded as actually an active strategy in waiting or developing the woman's own agency within the context of a very risky situation where she could face possible retaliation from the husband or condemnation by the community for being confrontational and challenging the status quo. The final concept that emerged from the interviews is the process of leaving revealed through women's stories. And as you can see from the diagram, most women did it in stages that involved series of decisions and actions unfolding over time. And I'll demonstrate in the next few slides how these stages evolved for the women. The first stage, called reaching the turning point, involved critical events or moments of sudden realization that domestic violence had become uncontrollable or intolerable, and that the problem wasn't going to be solved without external help. And so these quotes demonstrate that this turning point of sudden, you know, insight or wake-up call, where women thought that their eyes opened and they were somehow blind and naive before. For some women, turning point resulted from loss of hope that the abuser would ever change. And so the woman came to believe that the husband would never stop abusing them. And this mental shift in their thinking illuminated the basis for maintaining a positive outlook in the marriage and provided the impetus for leaving. The next kind of turning point was when women feared for the safety of their children and themselves. where it was literally a choice between life and death. And the main factor that led women to leave was when they were confronted with the pervasive fear leading to disability or death. The second stage of leaving was actual implementation of the leaving process. And as you can see from the diagram, it was never linear for them, but very cyclical in nature. And the women kept going back and forth until they reached this final saturation. But these previous attempts to leave explain to us the complex decision-making process where they carefully weighed the costs and benefits of staying and leaving in the face of cultural, institutional, and systemic constraints. The final stage of leaving is reclaiming and regaining self, which actually is about women's empowerment and resilience. But because I was interviewing women from the shelter who I think could have taken advantage of the interventions of the shelter and took time to sort of reflect on their experiences and think about their future, I think that social and material support from the shelter affected their outlook and enabled them to not go back and move on. The women explained that they wanted to rebuild their lives, obtain their education and jobs, and most importantly, gain peace of mind and sense of stability for their children. They had a strong desire to help other women experiencing the abuse. So the results of the study indicate that the culture of gender inequality and acceptance of domestic violence are primary barriers for help seeking. And although in my dissertation I discuss other more even universal factors, you know, such as husband's drinking and behavioral problems and larger societal problems such as poverty, and lack of socioeconomic capital of the woman, my study really views the problem of domestic violence more as a confluence of powerful sociocultural norms that sanction violence and abuse. It demonstrates how women fear the stigma and shame of seeking help, how men literally beat down their women, believing that, you know, it's normal and acceptable, and how other women agree with it, validated and perpetuated. Demonstrates how law enforcement and other public institutions don't recognize it and even organize themselves to minimize and perpetuate it. It shows how women endure the abuse relying on their own internal strengths, cunning, and problem-solving skills in the face of minimal support from family, community, and societal institutions. And finally, it shows how women reach some kind of a breaking point when they decide to leave after coping with years or decades of abuse and finding new meaning and hope from their experiences and lessons learned. So these narratives are pointing to potential places for social work interventions to be expanded. And at the societal level there needs to be new messages propagated about marriage and families. And what seems to be necessary is sensitizing families about taking back girls who are being abused, because shutting the door is the most natural and the most critical refuge, it seems, as being shut off. Secondly, it's important to train the responders, such as medical doctors and lawyers and police, to overcome their cultural biases, because high acceptance level of violence in Kyrgyzstan underscore the importance of training, because prior research shows that if the responders hold negative stereotypes that accept domestic violence, the responses could lead to what they call a double victimization. So the police response could be expanded to include social workers, counselors, and specialists who could come in when these cases are brought to police and have the role of pushing to understand the dynamic. Push the family to get involved and connect the victims to domestic violence services and husbands to seek help. It is necessary to design a specific governmental body responsible for measures related to domestic violence and developing the foundation and for sort of state funding mechanisms for a system-based framework of prevention and intervention. And it is necessary to ensure the availability of shelters, psychological, legal counseling, and help for the survivors of abuse, particularly in rural areas. For clinical practice, interventions focusing on recovery and models of psychological empowerment are important to overcome the shame, stigma of abuse. the findings from this study raise important questions that could serve as a basis for future research. And by design, the study focused on women survivors of abuse. But to develop a more holistic understanding, it might be necessary to explore male perspective and experiences on the topic and what measures could work to delegitimize their entitlement for abuse. It'd be also useful to explore mother-in-law's perspectives, who become or don't become the instigators of violence, to understand the conditions that shape that mentality of abusive dynamic and how women can break that cycle of oppression and abuse. And this could serve as a guide for intervention in the future. It'd be useful to conduct comparative research on risk factors, prevalence, and characteristics of domestic violence, not only in Central Asia, but also other regional studies in the former Soviet Union, to investigate what culturally competent practices could be developed in the area of social development, entrepreneurship and empowerment. The major limitation of the study, which is inherent for qualitative research, is that you can't generalize the results to the population, but I feel that the study limitations are far outweighed by the value of hearing the stories and the lived experiences of the women who made that difficult decision to seek help. Thank you.
So I have two questions. So, first of all, in the course of your interviews, so you describe these patterns as sort of the modal patterns, and you use these quotes to illustrate, but did you find any sorts of exceptions to the rule? Or did you find cases where mothers-in-law were supportive? Or, or was it really just pretty homogeneous in terms of the experiences of the women that you spoke to?
I wasn't surprised that it was pretty homogeneous, because these cultural experiences were, they really sort of outweighed the individual experiences of the women. I mean, the only woman who was a social worker actually and worked at the shelter said that, she was able to stop their abuse to some extent because she had a job and then moved on to sort of, you had a university degree. But most of the women, I did not have a case of a supportive mother-in-law. Or there weren't any sort of striking differences. I mean, I was trying to seek out those differences because of my constant comparative analysis and sort of the theoretical sampling of my theory and hypothesis, let's get a rich woman, who got into the shelter and she was incredibly rich because she owned several cars and several houses and a huge farm and had a great job. But then she was saying, I thought I was rich and look, all this money doesn't really matter, because when I tell my family about my experience, they say, well, what are you fussing about this one hit? You're not sort of, and I thought all these shelters were just for some poor and illiterate women, but look at me, the life forced me to come here. And so I think these cultural, experience sort of, they were kind of more generalized, I should say, across that whole sample, which, was a small sample, and it's within the shelter, which is what I could by the limit of my research, study.
Did you have a second follow-up?
Go ahead.
It actually ties in, I think, somewhat nicely to your question, and it was actually, I was wondering, you mentioned the theoretical sampling in your talk, and again, just mm-hmm. right now, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate that a little bit more as to how that affected your results?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I started just with a sort of a general criteria, which was the women residing in the shelter, but then my subsequent sampling was based on the evolving variables, because from sort of like a random net that I throw, right? And I interviewed this first woman who whose husband was a law enforcement official, which then created this very important variable of legal help seeking. Then, you know, as I interviewed more women, another important variable emerged was the family formations from different living structures, you know, and for example, around age or socio-demographic characteristics of the women, or like the presence of alcohol, for example, as a risk factor. So I think I tried my best to sort of get that sort of a more typical case and then more a contrasting case. But again, I think, you know, these cultural experiences were more sort of what cut across the whole sample and outweighed the individual characteristics. So, yeah.
Were the participants all from the same shelter? And if not, did you notice any patterns in their responses? And also, how does this shelter structure work in Kyrgyzstan? Is it, you know, is it confidential? Do you get there and no one knows where you are? And did the women bring their children? I assume so.
Yeah, the old women brought their children, except for a couple who really suffered from, you know, not having their kids with them. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it was all within the same shelter. I could have not done that because of my committee, who strongly thought that I should be only doing one shelter as my sort of a research site, because in fact, I was arguing in the very beginning, saying like the grounded theory really requires sort of following the story. And I, in fact, wanted to compare how the women cope and, you know, helps seek help when they're outside of the shelters. I think it was a practical reason that I needed to just interview from one sample. In terms of confidentiality, I made sure to work with the shelter to, give me a separate room so I could interview them, and I did not share any of the stories with any of the staff. And obviously, all the ethics of IRB, of, you know, making sure that you protect their identity and.
I think what I meant by confidentiality, though, was when the women got to the shelter, were they afforded the protection of confidentiality about their whereabouts, and would that have influenced their freedom to express themselves with you?
That's a good point, because in the IRB, they specifically want you to waiver the. So one of the mechanisms is also through the informed consent. Mm-hmm. And so I asked for the waiver of the informed consent because they particularly didn't want them to like have that paper with them. Like, so okay, so you're talking to this American researcher or something now, and then create even more, you know, danger for her. But the other thing is, I also tried to, you know, understand what their situation was and if you know, if it was a risk for her to talk about her experience with me, then obviously she would not be eligible for the study. I mean, that is very.
Do you have any sense of what would happen after a woman is in the shelter? So like, what is the realistic possibility to like go out knowing these cultural norms and have a life like with your children that would be safe or that would be reasonable outside of a shelter set of the of the shelter?
Yeah, the shelter is 21 days. That's sort of a standard. I mean, some women, they can live in their transitional housing, which is for 6 months. And some of the women actually did live there. But, you know, I wasn't following them. You know, it was not necessarily, I'm not aware of the fate of the women beyond a shelter.
Was the shelter offering, what were they working with them to maybe set them up economically, and like to get the women?
Absolutely. In fact, they run a program within the shelter called something like a social rehabilitation, where they teach them how to sew.
Mm-hmm.
And
and teach them how to do all these crafts. And then they also link them to some of the programs with the Ministry of Social and Legal Protection to make sure that they're, you know, economical, you know.
Mm-hmm. But you can know after for whether they are successful or if they express fear or not, and thinking not only just the shame associated with going back out and that instability, but also of the husband's family and what's going to happen there. And when they express something about like you, do you have any insights into that?
Yeah, the fear was the biggest factor, I think, among women as adults. And the shelter, I think the shelter did a great job, in fact, you know, talking to the women's families and talking to the abuser and sort of like a mediation situation between them and really trying to help what they could. And just providing a shelter was huge for this woman. They had no idea about the existence of these children.
How common are these shelters?
There are only 7 in the whole country. And they all roll over around 20 beds for 21 days. And this is like the one that's, you know, funded by the government. Mm-hmm. Most of them are just non-governmental-based organizations.
How about the women you interviewed? Where were they from versus like rural versus urban in town? Was it weighted in a certain direction? And if it was weighted towards mostly coming from towns and urban areas, is there a significant like barrier for women in the rural parts of the country to get to these shelters? Or,
so most of these women were like internal migrants.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So only one lived. Yeah, if you lived in Bishkek as like their permanent residence, but most of them were from rural areas.
Previously, you were talking about some empowered women, well-off family, for example, and I remember in the beginning you mentioned your sample of the 16 women. They have an income ranges from $2,000 a month or $2. So I'm wondering about the distribution of the.
So that was the only one who had the $2,000 income.
That's,
I told you about.
Yeah,
all the rest were just very low paying jobs,
yes.
Like about $1 a day.
I see.
So.
Yeah.
The $2,000 was the woman with the car.
Exactly. Yeah.
The
sorry, the social worker earned about $200 a month.
One comment and one question. Comment is that I think that for the women knowing that they can stay only 21 days in the shelter will probably prevent many of them going to the shelter in the first place, because they do not know what will happen thereafter. So,
but it's actually a last resort for them. I mean, it's not like they're
desperate.
Yeah, they were running for their lives. And some of them were just sitting on the bus stop, and the woman just came up to them, "Why are you crying? You know, she's with a child, and I don't know what to do. I just, leave."
And another question: you growing up in Kyrgyzstan, I'm wondering what was your idea, what was your concept, or your experiences of these cultural forces which can promote discrimination and violence against women, and how did your understanding change in the process of studying the subject and the women's research?
Well, I think as a self-reflexive researcher who was embedded in the culture, I think I was trying to ask whether it rings true and whether it confirms sort of the common knowledge, or trying to check against my personal experience, and generally, it did confirm those cases. But I would say that I
has sort of taken out my comfort zone also quite a bit, especially, you know, in those specific, you know, law enforcement and child sexual abuse cases, for example. And I think it really extended my understanding of domestic violence situation in Kyrgyzstan. And I think it was pretty powerful that it also confirmed that these sort of commonalities, like in some parts of India or Pakistan, some other countries that I didn't read research about too. And it sort of gave me the confidence that, you know, I'm able to lay the foundation for future interventions to build on.
I came in late, so you might have addressed this, but is there any public discourse about this? Is there, are any of your, any themes of educating the public or any pushback on this as a practice or or is it pretty much underground?
Oh, it's huge among the women's organizations. For example, the shelter that I was working with, the director is very charismatic, really, you know, and she's been working on this theme for 20 years. And in fact, she was the one who, you know, mobilized the women's network to collect the 30,000 signatures and get the law passed, you know, on violence against women, the first law in the history of Kyrgyzstan, to address some this problem specifically. And so I think these are activists who, you know, try to do some, you know, public information campaigns and, you know, work with schools, work with communities to promote nonviolence and healthy relationships. But I think it, as I was saying in the beginning, they weren't really able to address it at societal level because, you know, it's, there are many levels, layers, as I was talking about in the sort of the primary, secondary, tertiary levels that have to be sort of on a system basis.
How often would you say children were also subject to abuse?
In most cases.
In most cases.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just for MS abuse.
Mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts on that, vis-a-vis thinking of the place of women and the daughter-in-law in society and that being a part of the acceptance and perpetuation of abuse of women, but what sort of societal factors might accept abuse of children as well, if that their place and their role, and what is the ecology of that?
It's a great point. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the Honduras social learning theory, which really underlines that, the kids see that behavior, and then they, you know, it's very intergenerational, and they learn to do it within their families, and then the girls are learning to tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in most of the cases, the women were saying, well, my mother just told me it's okay, you know, everybody endures that.
Were male children also getting hit, or mostly daughters?
For male children, the women were more concerned that they would have psychological problems.
Okay.
You know, they really were saying that, I don't, you know, I want to leave because I don't want him to become
okay. Don't want them to see that and think it's okay. But in terms of the actual abuse, it was mostly against the daughters, the female children?
Well, against the sons as well.
Oh, okay.
She has a point, though. It would be really interesting when you mentioned comparative research to look at the for the, what was it, 61% who don't perpetuate this despite the normalization of this behavior culturally, right? What is it that stops that? Or
what way child abuse is normalized? Because I understand how you explain the abuse of the wives being normalized, but how is the child abuse normalized?
Again, it's for family, you know, if you know, if he's learning by, you know, modeling the behavior, and he's seeing that every day,
uh-huh.
He's seeing that his grandmother, which is a mother-in-law,
you know, saying that it's okay. You know, they're gonna catch you. It's a good cycle.
I'm wondering whether you see some generational change. Whether the younger generations have maybe a different perception, more awareness of sexual violence, and whether the traditions maybe impact any of our with the younger generations.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because some of the women were saying, well, you know, it's, you know, ask for this. Well, you know, the women were like, what, 35, 40 years old, and were saying, it's us who tolerate this and endure this. But the younger generation, they're not going to do this. They're going to say, you know, either leave with your mommy or, you know, with me. I can't, you know, stand that. So it's interesting that there might be generational change. However, as I was mentioning in my presentation, it could be that this, you know, resurgence of traditional values is also creating situation where women, you know, first of all, they're wearing very, very conservative clothes. I see more than English shapeliness that I was visiting, you know, last month. And I see more mosques, you know, sort of women not going to school, but they're going to some religious school. Mm-hmm. They're not educating themselves. So I think those some of the barriers could be, you know, creating, you know, some of the differences as well. So.
So I'm wondering, so you know, to me, I mean, it's very disturbing, of course, to hear about this particular role in women laws, but it's also disturbing to hear about the attitudes of the police and the imams. So I'm wondering, did you talk to any police? Did you talk to any imams? Do you have any sort of external confirmatory evidence to respect
that
the imams in particular are that? I mean, are they really telling people, go beat your wife?
I am dying to know that. Yes, I am wondering. Go next time and ask those imams, because this was truly disturbing to me too, because, you know, actually, you know, if you think about religions, actually, you know, it's about nonviolence and not sort of respecting the woman, you know, for rights. So I don't know about those, but this is not the first time I was hearing though from the women. Yeah, but talking to police would be one, you know, important, you know.
On the other hand, why would a victim need that? I mean, there's a part of me, like, I understand from a scientific point of view you want to validate, but I don't know, the question's resonating with me in an odd way.
I don't know that, but maybe let's not think about it as validation, because I agree with you, why would you come up with that? But just, I think it would be enriching, why not, to have that at the perspective of the voice from the other side that is causing that here to sort of enrich that cultural context in which it's happening, to hear the voice of the imam as well as the woman.
Well, I think I acknowledge that limitation of my study, because it was really... Right. And for me, it was actually important to focus on the women's stories and how they construct in their own words, you know, their understanding of violence. Yeah.
I think it would be very interesting to actually interview the husband as well. So it might not be the same husband.
Sure.
Would be getting,
like I said,
you know, that would be very interesting, because I think that would actually confirm those very strongly.
It's more like a
and in Kyrgyzstan, actually, even less so than in Tajikistan, women are more empowered than Tajik women, for example. So, but it would be very interesting to kind of, because the men are socialized, right, in that way. So it would be very interesting to kind of hear their justification and their perspective why I feel that this is necessary. This is a justified behavior towards my wife.
So you suggested that this might have something to do with the resurgence of traditional values, and I'm thinking in the Soviet period they probably tried to do something about this. So my question is, did you ask these women about their religious backgrounds? I mean, are they from secular families? Are they from religious families? Does it make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
So I did not have a direct question that asked what her religion, what the religion was. I assumed that because, you know, Wonder Woman was actually very conservatively dressed, so I assumed she was Muslim, and she also talked about the same one for her husband that way. But I don't think it's any religious based. Mm-hmm. I think I would agree with you for Soviet Union try to eliminate those gender discrepancies. I'm trying to say that most of the society is actually secular, if I can say so. So it's not, you know, in fact, the government is trying to push back, you know, to those fundamental sort of religious groups that are trying to, you know, spread their influence.
But was there less domestic violence against women during the Soviet times?
Something was hidden behind closed doors, right? It wasn't necessarily researched that much. Plus, maybe because of the I would say I knew many of my relatives who did that to their wives and still doing that, and so I've seen it many, many times to say that I do believe those figures when they say it's 1 in 4 women, maybe more.
Mm-hmm. May I point out that even in Anpato's writings, there's examples of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe at that time, the sort of uncertainty and the economic pressures were not such as today, which also I think contributed to stress in the family and violence. So I think that might have been a difference.
Well, this looks like it's probably a good moment to thank you for you're welcome to come up to Saltanat and ask her more, but I was very impressed by the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all for facilitating.
Thank you.